This episode is brought to you by Curie Briefs, the smartest 3-minute read in medicine. Think of it like mental floss for busy clinicians. Sharp, concise, and clinically relevant. Check it out today at Curie.md. And now, on to the show.
Hey, Curie listeners. On today's episode, we welcome Mary Roach. Mary has spent her career diving into the strange and often peculiar corners of science. Cadavers, digestion, even the physics of sex. But in her latest book, Replaceable You, Mary takes us into burn units, stem cell labs, and yes, even a pigsty in China, to ask a deceptively simple question. Can we ever really replace what nature gave us? Today on Curie, I talk with Mary about the future of replacement parts, the moments that made her laugh out loud in the middle of a lab, and why our bodies might just be more irreplaceable than we think. Mary Roach, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
You've taken readers on some pretty unforgettable journeys over the years, from cadavers to the digestive system to even the science of sex. But in your newest book titled Replaceable You, you're looking at what happens when we try to repair or even replace parts of the human body. So, Mary, what drew you to this topic in the first place?
Well, I'm 66 and everything's going to wear out soon. So that's part of it. But I think, for most of my career, I've written about the human body in some way, shape, or form. So it's, in some ways, it was kind of a logical fit for me. But what kind of sparked an interest was a conversation I had with a reader who, she mentioned that she's an amputee, and specifically she's an elective amputee. So she's someone who her foot was malformed because of spina bifida. She'd had a number of surgeries trying to correct it, never really corrected it. She couldn't walk well. She couldn't hike. She couldn't do the things that she would see people with a below-the-knee prosthetic doing really well and really effortlessly. And she was like, why can't I find a surgeon to cut off my foot? Like, please, somebody take my foot, please. You know, and it took her years to find a surgeon who would do the amputation. And I just found that interesting, you know, that sense of, you know, or wondering, you know, why were the surgeons hesitant? At what point, you know, are there ways to make that decision more easily or more meaningfully? You know, how does that all work? So anyway, that was kind of where things got rolling, I think.
Why do you think that is? Why is there still so much resistance to replacement, even if replacement could give someone a better life? Why do you think medicine pushes so hard to preserve?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. One of them is quite simply, you know, will insurance pay? You have to make the case for that being a necessary procedure, and otherwise, you know, insurance might not pay. I think there's also concern, like, what if the patient ends up with phantom limb pain that they didn't have before, and they're angry with me, or they sue me, or you know, one surgeon said it may just be if you're not used to doing amputations, you might not be comfortable doing an amputation. You know, there are techniques, fairly, you know, recent techniques that are aimed at preventing phantom limb pain. So, but if that's not what you do in your practice, you might not really want to do that. There's also, you know, doctors are they're trained to fix things, and it's just easier to go, you know what, let's try one more thing. Let's try one more procedure. Let's see if we can fix this. And to do that again and again. And also, you're in that way, I think the feeling is you're giving them hope that they can be repaired with their original parts. And there's a bit of a, you know, it's a very it's an act of finality to cut off a body part, you know, that's healthy. I mean, that was a healthy foot. It was an underperforming foot, but it had a blood supply and it wasn't gangrenous. And it's a gray area, I think, for a surgeon. But if you talk to prosthetists, people who work with amputees, or there's also people in the medical community who've come up with scores that like ways to assess the situation, and also have looked at comparing pain and functionality with a prosthetic limb versus limb salvage, which is operation after operation after operation. There's a lot of clear-cut cases where the patient is better off with a prosthetic lower limb.
Did working on this book and doing the research for this book, did this change the way that you see the human body?
Anytime I write a book, I get, for a while anyway, this kind of heightened awareness of whatever part I'm looking at. You know, when I was writing Gulp, which had to do with the whole alimentary canal from nose to mouth to butt, I remember talking to this guy who studied chewing, like all these amazing things that go on that we're not aware of when we're chewing. Like when you're biting down on a peanut and the peanut gives way, there's a reflex that cuts out the muscle force so that you don't smash your teeth together. I was like, wow. And then reading about what happens when you're chewing, you know, you're breaking down this, say, piece of bread, and then you're putting it back together with your saliva to form a bolus that will go down the esophagus. And I was like, that's disgusting. And just like becoming aware of what's going on in my mouth, because you're not aware. For the most part, we think of ourselves as just sort of a mind moving through the world on this device, this thing called the body. And we're not aware of all the thousands of things that are going on. And so when you write a book like this, when you write a book about the body and you suddenly are aware, sometimes you do have that kind of awkward, like you'd rather not know. But most of the time, I feel like it's just a sort of sense of awe. Like, I think it's good to be reminded that it is this tremendous machine that we've been given that does these things without our asking it to, just behind the scenes doing all this work, and we're just moving along completely unaware of it. So I think a little awareness is healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, within the book and within Replaceable, you take us to some fantastic scenes and some very memorable scenes, including, you know, burn units and stem cell hair nurseries and even a pig facility in China. If you had to just pick one scene from the book that you'd want every listener to experience and to see through your eyes, what would that be?
One scene. I guess the scene that was most awe-inspiring to me. I mean, there were some that were just flat out weird, but the one that was kind of awe-inspiring. I was at the University of Michigan Extracorporeal Life Support Laboratory. So extracorporeal meaning outside the body. So this lab concerns itself with creating ways, like things like a portable wearable lung replacement or ECMO machine. The ECMO machine was pioneered by the director of this lab, Bob Bartlett. But the day that I was there, they were working on ways to extend the shelf life, if you will, of a heart that's been taken from a deceased donor and will be transplanted in someone else. And if, you know, right now, most of those hearts are just put on ice and shipped as quickly as possible, you know, 4 to 6 hours, preferably before they go into the new patient, because you don't want them to start to, you know, degrade. But they were looking at ways to extend that from, like there's perfusion systems that are now used that can take you up to like 12 hours, but they were looking at like, could we get that to 24 or 48 or even weeks or hypothetically months. But the scene that was amazing to me. It was a study using a pig. The pig was completely anesthetized, and they removed the heart because they were going to put it on sort of a perfusion rig, like what I was just talking about. And the heart came out, and it keeps on beating. Like a heart will keep beating outside a body for as long as 10 minutes. And I found that just incredible, just that there's this, you know, the extent to which body parts really want to just do what they're meant to do. You know, this is what I do. I'm a heart. I beat. And even at another lab, I saw heart muscle cells, cardiomyocytes, under a microscope, a whole layer of them beating in unison, beating, you know, like we're heart muscle cells. We're heart cells. This is what we do. We beat, you know, there they are. They're beating under a microscope. And that was just amazing to me to see. And so you have me there being completely awestruck. And then the surgeon, he was maybe a research fellow. Anyway, he was explaining to me that he said, yeah, sometimes I have to take a sample to send it to the pathology lab, and I got to like do a very thin slice, and it's still beating, and it's really annoying for me, which I thought was, you know, I felt awe, but he was just talking about how annoying it was that hearts keep on beating.
Yeah, one of the processes that you also write about in the book is called decellularization, if I'm saying that correctly. And as I understand it, you write about how difficult it is to get all of those individual cells back into the right places and back into the organ so that the organ can start functioning as normal.
I cut you off. What was your question?
No, I was going to ask, you know, can you tell us about that process and what did you come to understand about why nature is so hard to copy?
The person who told me about decellularization and recellularization, or decell recell, as it's known, is the director of the Feinberg Lab at Carnegie Mellon University, and it's a bioprinting lab. And he was talking about how he got very excited back in the day when there was this idea that you could take a heart, okay, and you could pump detergent through using the arterial system, you know, the capillaries, the same way a mortician embalms, like using the circulatory system to deliver material to all the cells. So you could, if you pump through this detergent, which breaks down the outer layer of the cells, you can essentially just wash away all the living cells. And now you're left with this extracellular stuff, collagen and support structure. And if you go online, you look up ghost heart, you'll see these white kind of eerie looking hearts that are, it's just the scaffold basically. So there was this thought that, okay, you do that and you have this scaffold of an organ. And now if you use that same system, you could just pump in cellular material. You know, you could take a scaffold from one person, extracellular material, and then like pump in cells and create this organ that could be used for transplant. It was kind of this hope and dream that was something that was workable. But the problem is that the stuff that got rinsed away is tiny, much smaller than whole cells. And to get those, you know, to get whole cells back through that system was very, very difficult and almost impossible. And also, if there's different types of cells, how do you tell them where to get off the boat, you know? Like, so that didn't work. But it was an interesting, and the photographs of these ghost hearts are fascinating. The whole make a scaffold and then shoot the cells through thing didn't quite work. But bioprinting is a pretty exciting process. It's got a long way to go. Nobody is printing organs. They're still trying to figure out things like, the day I was there, there were a number of researchers looking at printing muscle, and there's no such thing as just muscle. It depends, like how the cells are aligned depends on what the function of that muscle is. So, you know, for a heart. They're actually arranged in kind of a helix, because the heart, when it pumps, when it squeezes, it twists a little bit, kind of like wringing out a wet shirt. So it's, you know, trying to get the most blood volume out with each pump. So you have to arrange, you got to print the cells in that specific alignment, which is different than, say, muscle that's a ring contracting, like around the mouth, or the shoulder, which has this amazing range of motion where the cells are aligned in kind of a fan shape, delta shape. So you have this idea. It's like, well, it's like printing a four-color brochure. You just swap between the extruder heads, and it's just really fascinatingly complicated. So, it's going to be a while before anybody's printing an organ that can be installed in a person. Like, at least 10 years, probably 20, maybe 30, depending on who you ask.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of hype and a lot of buzz, yes. But it sounds like we're still pretty far away from that becoming a tangible reality.
Yeah.
I also know, you know, readers of your past work, really appreciate your knack for, you know, unearthing kind of these strange and peculiar and even funny details. And so one thing that I wanted to ask was if there was a moment during the research for Replaceable You that actually made you laugh out loud.
Well, there were a lot of them. A moment that made me laugh out loud. I think there were a lot of them are the things that I ended up putting in footnotes, you know, things like I learned that in the 1700s, blood transfusion from person to person, which is how it used to be done before there was blood banking, they would just hook up a tube from one person to the other. But there were some people that advocated transfusions as a form of therapy. Like if you got a little bit of blood from a more cheerful person, maybe you wouldn't be such a depressive. Also, it could be used as a kind of couples therapy where each member of the couple got a little of the other person's blood, and that would make them more compatible. I think this was the 1700s. So it's not contemporary, but I remember thinking, well, would that it were so simple.
I want to ask a little bit about your research process as well. How do you decide which labs or hospitals or field sites to visit? What makes you say, there's a story here and there's a story that I want to explore?
I like for all of my chapters to be able to go somewhere. So that right there rules out a lot of places. I mean, I have a chapter on xenotransplantation, which is genetically editing pigs such that their heart or kidney or whatever it is going to provoke a less extreme reaction from the immune system. So there are two companies here that are doing this work. One of them entering clinical trial, I think, is starting this month. But and they were both very nice to talk to, but they both said, no, you can't come here. We don't. I think that's fairly common with biotech companies. They're not, their way of dealing with writers and the press is more, here's a press kit, here's a video, this is what we're giving out. We don't want you coming here and asking things that you want to ask. This is what we're going to give you. That's sort of how they do it. And in that case, it ended up being, since they'd said no, I wanted to visit the pig facility, the designated pathogen-free, super clean pigsty. And since they said no, I looked around online and I found someone, Xiaoping Deng, had been working on xenotransplantation for 30 years in Chengdu, China. And I contacted him and his assistant, who also works in the same field. Said, sure, you could come here and you're welcome. We'll show you our facility. And also, I think China was in some ways a better setting because there is such a dearth of organs for transplant. It's not culturally something that's done to donate your organs. So there is a tremendous need there for organs. So the to be able to use pig organs would be a huge boon for them. So it kind of made some sense. But to answer your question, it comes down to number one, is there, can I go and see something? And is there something going on that will be an interesting narrative for the reader? And does that person say yes? Because they don't always say yes. People have reasons. I mean, that in some ways, there's no reason for them to say yes. I'm not paying them. They don't control what I'm going to say. It's kind of a miracle that anybody says yes to me, you know? That's kind of how it happens. And it's a lot of just, I the first few months of a book, I just send out a tremendous number of emails to people I just have stumbled onto either on the internet or somebody told me about them. And I'm just writing to them saying, hey, what do you got cooking in the next year and a half? And is it possible for me to show up and spend some time? And so every now and then someone says yes.
Yeah, I love learning about writers' processes. And so I wanted to ask, you know, after immersing yourself in all of these different frontiers, from, you know, pig hearts to bioprinting to all of these different kinds of unusual and odd surgeries, what did you come away admiring most about the human body?
Well, I think the complexity of it is really borne out by how hard it is to replace something in the human. And that makes a certain amount of sense because medicine and engineering science have had, you know, a few hundred years to figure things out, whereas the body has had, as you know, so we're talking about millions of years of evolution. So it's a pretty steep challenge to try to create something that works as seamlessly as a system, you know, to try to do that using man-made materials or genetic editing. It's just incredibly complex. And, you know, even if you could print an organ, you know, how do you incorporate it? You know, it needs to be fed. Are you going to print all the capillaries? And there's all, you know, just there's a lot going on kind of behind the scenes in the human body that some of it just not figured out yet. And so I guess I'm just always impressed by how complex it really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of people think of the human body kind of as a machine with these interchangeable parts, and you can replace this piece and swap out that piece, but it really is so complex that kind of defies any comparison. Mary, this has been a fantastic conversation. I really enjoyed learning about your process and hearing some of the stories and anecdotes from your book. For our listeners who want to follow more of your content, where is the best place for them to start?
I think this is book number 8. So the books are all listed on my website, which is maryroach.net. And I'm on Instagram at author Mary Roach. So those are a couple places to start.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mary.
Oh, yeah. You're so welcome, Andrew. Thanks a lot for doing this.